Michael, you love diamonds as much as the next guy.
I do?
Oh, yes. Even more, I suspect. So I have some very good news for you. Messika, one of my favorite high jewelry houses, has opened a flagship boutique on Madison Avenue right here in New York City.
Well, this is a very big deal.
Indeed. And you thought you had to make a trip to Paris to select that perfect diamond bracelet for your lovely wife. Now, just as Messika celebrates its 20th anniversary, its new U.S. boutique has arrived. Dedicated to fine and high jewelry, it is full of exclusive, limited edition creations that even the most discerning collector is sure to love.
Drop by the sparkling new flagship at 727 Madison Avenue between 63rd and 64th Streets, or experience the joy of Parisian savoir-faire at Messika.com. That's Messika.com.
Happy Saturday. It's September 20th, 2025, and you are listening to Morning Meeting. I'm Ashley Baker in Trumpified London.
And I'm Michael Haney in New York City.
And we are two of your airmail editors who are here to take you far away from the news of the day. But first, here's what's been happening this week. In Los Angeles, Jimmy Kimmel's show has been suspended for his comments on the killing of Charlie Kirk. In London, Trump got the royal treatment he has always craved. And in Delaware, President Macron and his wife Brigitte have presented scientific evidence and photographs that proves that she is, in fact, a woman. This is going to be used as evidence in their libel suit in the U.S. against Candace Owens, the right-wing influencer and blogger who claims that Brigitte Macron wasn't born a man. What a world, Michael, that we live in. But as always, airmail is your antidote to all of it.
Yeah, we've got a great show. You know, first, Nicholas Rockefeller, Yaley Davos man, member of multiple boards, died a pillar of the East Coast establishment, as every man with the Rockefeller name does. Then, however, the truth about his life came out, and Jonathan Alter is here to share his report about the man. Then, you're not wrong if you think the world suddenly has nepomania, where we once were content to obsess ourselves merely with the lives of the rich and powerful. Now we find we must obsess over their children, like the Guinness family, which seems to be everywhere in London. Even more so now that Netflix has launched a glossy new drama about the earliest days of the world's most enduring brewing dynasty. But as our man in London, Joseph Beaumont, reports, can this series make sense of one of the most cursed families in Europe? And finally, no doubt many of you have had the joy of dining at Union Square Cafe here in New York City, one of the city's great restaurants. This year, it turns 40, and our correspondent, Christine Mulkey, sat down with the owner, Danny Meyer, to ask him about those early days in 1985 and what he learned. So, Ashley, where would you like to begin today?
Michael, in the interest of good news, let's talk to Christine Mulkey about Danny Meyer. Christine is a journalist who has covered the food and dining scene in New York City for many years. She was an editor at Bon Appetit and the New York Times, and now she's one of our writers at large. And she brings us inside the magical universe of the Union Square Cafe back in its very early days, just as the restaurant celebrates its 40th anniversary. Welcome, Christine.
Thank you. Good morning.
Okay, your story this week takes us back to one of our favorite places in New York City, which is the bar at the Union Square Cafe when it was in its original location on 16th Street. How has 40 years passed since that wonderful restaurant opened?
I mean, well, that's a really important question. You know, I was just biking past 16th Street and it's such a different world. The world that Danny Meyer embraced, there were still sort of chalk outlines of murder victims in the park when he would come in the morning. There were publishing and advertising agencies with budgets and people who ate lunch there every day. You could smoke there. And there was still not a thing that we call a foodie. So it was really a special moment in time that has just been, you know, obliterated. But the bar still exists in a form.
So when Danny Meyer opened the restaurant, I mean, he was so young. How old was he?
I think he was 27.
How did he get into this business?
So he originally was studying journalism and politics, which for everyone who wants him to, you know, political science, sorry, for everyone who wants him to run for mayor, there's actually a basis in fact here. And he was about to take the LSATs and he went out with his uncle at Elio's, which is still one of his touchstone places. And he was super depressed. And his uncle was like, why are you so down? He said, you know, I'm taking this test and I don't really want to go, you know, pass the bar, do this. He's like, why would you do something that you hate? He's like, how long are you going to be alive versus how long will you be dead? Exactly. Don't do something you dislike. So he said, okay, and he took the test, and then he immediately went to one of those banks, you know, the banks of the plastic bins with the free weeklies that you still, which are actually still around. And he took out one for the learning addicts, and he found the New York Restaurant School, and was on the 8th floor walk-up of a garment center loft, totally dingy. And he took himself to restaurant school because his uncle said, ever since I've known you, all you talk about is food and restaurants. Why don't you do that? And Danny was, you know, he's like, that's not a career. It's 1984, 85 at the time. You know, you don't take a liberal arts degree and open a restaurant. But one of the things that encouraged him at the New York Restaurant School is one of the other students was the former president of Alfa Romeo. And he was there because he wanted to open a restaurant. And he did. It was Mezzogiorno, which I don't know if you remember, but it was quite successful in the 80s. So that was the only key that or sign that he had that opening a restaurant was actually a legitimate thing to do. Then he waited tables for 8 months. He worked at Pesca in what was then just labeled by New York Magazine as the Flatiron District. And he met his wife there, and he met Michael Romano, who became the chef there. And then he went to Italy and learned, and then he came back and he pounded the pavement. So, you know, he makes it sound easy. It took 2 years from the epiphany to opening day.
Was it an immediate hit?
Took about 5 weeks. And one of the things that opened October 21st, and he didn't know that the Halloween parade ended at Union Square. And the Halloween parade was also very different. So he's... They said there were shirtless men four deep at the bar, and someone had padlocked a 12-foot tall erection to the awning. So that was, you know, but that took a while, and it took about 5 weeks for people really to start coming, and then they were off to the races.
Here we are 40 years later, and Danny's empire extends far beyond Union Square. I mean, people around the world know him for Shake Shack, which is his burger chain. But how did he grow from Danny Myers, the 20-year-old behind one of the coolest restaurants in downtown New York, to probably one of the most successful entrepreneurs in the dining space that this country's ever produced?
That's a great question. And, you know, because there's so much history with Union Square Cafe, to just focus on that for 800 words for this story for you was really hard. I mean, to just keep the lens right there and not talk about Danny Meyer, you know, capital D, capital M. He's smart. He's nice. He has impeccable timing. And he really built a culture. And he built a culture of service, which honestly, at the time, service in New York was still the sort of Studio 54. Or, you know, and then the son of that being kind of like Indochine, you know, if I want you in my section, I'll put you there. But it's not, this wasn't about palming a 50 to the maitre d'. It was about making people feel welcome, feeding them well, and giving them a sense of value for their food. And that was kind of, that was revolutionary at the time. So I think he sort of went from one success to the other, but people followed him because they trusted him, because above all, Danny's just a super expletive, nice guy.
You know, Christine, that's kind of like, I love that you make the point in your story. He brought a culture clash to New York City because at that time, you know, everyone was too cool. Like service didn't really matter. Hospitality didn't really matter. It was either fancy French restaurants or these kind of dives. But he only hired Midwesterners. He was from St. Louis, right? And he gave them odd tests about, tell us the one you've gotten in the story, which I think is great as well.
And he said, you know, I could probably get, you know, I'd be in trouble for this now, but he wouldn't hire people who grew up in New York. And one of the questions was Hellman's or Miracle Whip? And I was like, well, Hellman's. I mean, Danny, are we having this conversation? He's like, well, you would have been hired. But he said, one of the servers said, oh, neither. I make my own aioli. And he said, okay, you're very hired. So yeah, he wanted to make sure that they made people feel welcome. And he took advice. Like once he got called out, Julia Child came to the restaurant, and this was sort of his dream, and he got to sit with her, and they put away, or maybe she put away, I couldn't really tell from the transcript, but there were two bottles of Beaujolais consumed, there were two plates of oxtail consumed, and I think he didn't actually eat with her, a lot of bread and butter. And then he received a handwritten letter the next week from somebody who worked at the Times and said, I guess no one else in the restaurant was important enough for your attention because no one else is Julia Child. And that was the night he realized he had to make sure that everybody felt special, and also end on the special table, don't start on the special table. And the people at the special table will be grateful also, because then they could just have their meal in peace.
People forget how different the city was back then. But I think one of the breakthroughs that Meyer shares and that you report so well in the story is, you know, back then he was a guy on his own eating at restaurants. And now, of course, everyone eats at the bar. It's like standard, like a restaurant. Back then, you could never really eat at the bar, but he sort of introduced that and he made it also very comfortable for people. Tell us about that.
Well, he cracked the code because part of what he was doing, he was walking the city and he would stop and have a drink and a bite at each place. And of course, they didn't want to seat him, God forbid, because he was a single man in his 20s. And that's apparently not okay. And so he would sit and eat. And also by the time he got to Tribeca, he was pretty tipsy, by the way. But it was physically difficult to eat at the bar because the bar has that lip. So how are you going to, you know, get over there and cut your steak? So he decided that he wanted to make the bar not only welcoming from a service point of view, of course, come here, bring your book, we have room for you, here's a candle, but also that they could physically eat. And people really welcome that. And so now that bar, half of it was taken out, the mahogany bar, and it's sort of on the mezzanine at Union Square Cafe, which moved in 2015 or 2016 to Park Avenue South. So if you're a real regular, you go there. And Danny believes that if you touch it, you can feel the energy of the original Union Square Cafe. You can. They could have yoga retreats on it.
Christine, 40 years is such a long time to be in any sort of business. And one of the remarkable things about Danny is his enthusiasm that he still brings to the job every single day. I mean, you have covered so many chefs and so many restaurants over the course of your amazing career in journalism. If you had to just sort of briefly explain the Danny Meyer magic and sort of where he falls in the canon of great American restaurateurs, how would you sum him up?
He saw it and he built it, but not for a business opportunity. It was for pure love, for love of dining, for love of being in a room with people who enjoy dining as much as you did. There's this man lacks cynicism. And I think that in many ways that acts, you know, that protected him. He creates great rooms, great environments, great meals.
Well, Christine, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, well, we should probably move on to other matters. We've now figured out exactly what you should be eating, and now we will move on to what you should be drinking in the wonderful world of the Guinness family. Joseph Bullmore, who's a writer at large at Airmail, as well as the editor of the Gentleman's Journal here in London. Joe takes us inside the universe of this famous family that is now the subject of a new 8-part historical drama called House of Guinness that is arriving on Netflix next week. Welcome, Joe.
Hello, both. Good to be here.
Why are they such ripe characters to explore dramatically?
I think because they've been going for such a long time and so successfully. A lot of dynasties seem to sort of flame out after 3 generations. That's usually the rule. One gets all the money, one grows it a bit, and then the third generation, the grandchildren, usually spend it all. But the Guinnesses are still going as a sort of Anglo-Irish equivalent to the Kennedys, maybe, or the Gettys, perhaps. Some 350, I think, or something, years after they first invented the very famous beer which bears their name. They're interesting for that reason alone, but along the way, they've had some pretty colourful, shall we say, adventures, both for better and for worse. And there's been some big, big characters, not just on the business side, but also, I suppose, on the more social side of life.
So to which Guinness do we owe the Guinness dynasty? Who is a patriarch of this great clan?
So I suppose that the inventor of Guinness is Arthur Guinness, who discovered the stout or porter beer that bears his name. But it was his grandson, Sir Benjamin Guinness, who really kind of ran with it and marketed it around the world and was the one who, yeah, kind of made it into an international powerhouse business, over which, on his death, his children began to sort of squabble, which is the action of the Netflix drama, which is coming out in a week's time. And it bears quite a lot of resemblance, I suppose, to Succession. There's 3 sons and 1 daughter, all of whom are fighting over the legacy, both financial and otherwise, of this man, Sir Benjamin Guinness, who, by all accounts, as you might expect, was a formidable character, I think.
As you note, also, I mean, like, when Arthur died in 1803, he was wealthier than the King of England. So, I mean, okay for selling stuff that you buy in a pub.
Yeah, he didn't do badly at all. And they maintain that wealth, which is kind of remarkable throughout the centuries. The Guinnesses held on and, in fact, grew their wealth.
Joe, we always say in West London, like, you can't walk down the street without running into one of these people. And we all have our favorites. Mine is Sabrina Guinness, who's the wife of Tom Stoppard. She was like the quintessential it girl in London in the 1980s. So chic, so nice, so friendly, so talented. We love Daphne, too. Who is your favorite Guinness?
Oh, I don't know. I wouldn't want to say. You put me on the spot there. What's interesting about the Guinnesses is that now in London, they have a sort of a brand name recognition which goes beyond just the financial or the drink. A Guinness in your head is a probably very social person, quite creative, maybe colourful in lots of ways, and always interesting characters. They haven't sort of slipped into dull normality. There's something quite fun about them. And perhaps, if it's too simplifying to say, but perhaps an Irish charm, a sort of twinkle in the eye when you meet a decent Guinness. But I won't name a favourite, I don't think. That's too dangerous.
Joe, in your story, you delineate some of the fascinating ways that Guinnesses have died. I mean, talk about drama. Give us some greatest hits of how this has happened.
Yeah. The other remarkable thing about the Guinnesses is, I suppose, like the Kennedys, like the Gettys, like the Astors, there is always a rumour that this curse stalks them. It's called, quite pleasingly, the Black Curse of the Guinnesses, in homage to the very dark drink that they make. And yeah, I mean, it's hard to deny that they have had quite a lot of bad luck, often involving fast cars. Tara Brown, who was a Guinness and sort of a fixture of swinging 60s London, he's said to have given Paul McCartney his first ever tab of LSD. And at his 21st birthday, the Rolling Stones flew in to perform. So he was a big deal. And he was driving his Lotus Elan at apparently 106 miles per hour through Kensington when, yeah, the inevitable happened and he crashed. And in fact, the song A Day in the Life by the Beatles is all about him. I think there's a line about he blew his brains out in a car. I think it's the line John Lennon writes about him the morning he heard the news that he died. But there were loads of car crashes throughout the sort of Guinness dynasty, and lots of unfortunate deaths in other ways, including, sadly, to do with sort of drug overdoses, as you'd expect. The most colourful one probably in the late 80s, when Olivia Channon, who was a Guinness, died of a heroin overdose in the rooms of the very colourful aristocrat Gottfried von Bismarck at Oxford. And yeah, that's kind of typical, I think, probably, of many Guinnesses in people's popular imagination. An unlucky clan who flirted too much, maybe, with the fast life that their wealth afforded them. They're certainly a colourful character, a family, and I'm glad we've got them, really. We don't produce interesting, big, sprawling clans in the way that perhaps America does. So it's good to have them. It's good to have a kind of fascination with them.
Well, Joe, thank you so much. Can't wait to talk to you about the show.
Super. Thanks, guys.
Michael, you love diamonds as much as the next guy.
I do?
Oh, yes. Even more, I suspect. So I have some very good news for you. Messika, one of my favorite high jewelry houses, has opened a flagship boutique on Madison Avenue right here in New York City.
Well, this is a very big deal.
Indeed. And you thought you had to make a trip to Paris to select that perfect diamond bracelet for your lovely wife. Now, just as Messika celebrates its 20th anniversary, its new U.S. boutique has arrived. Dedicated to fine and high jewelry, it is full of exclusive, limited edition creations that even the most discerning collector is sure to love.
Drop by the sparkly new flagship at 727 Madison Avenue between 63rd and 64th Streets, or experience the joy of Parisian savoir-faire at Messika.com. That's Messika.com.
If you thought that we were done with cursed people and troubling characters, ha, how wrong you were. We have a fascinating story about a Rockefeller. We were on an editorial call today and we were sort of asking this question, like, why are so many imposters and charlatans Rockefellers or pretending to be Rockefellers? And our story in the issue this week partially answers that question. Jonathan Alter, a journalist and the author of several books, including American Reckoning, Inside Trump's Trial, and my own, brings us inside the very strange world of Nicholas Rockefeller, a pillar of the West Coast establishment who was not exactly the man he seemed to be. Welcome, Jonathan.
Thanks for having me.
So in 2024, the world lost another Rockefeller, and all of the tributes and glorifying opportunities fell upon this particular moment. But your reporting exposes that Nicholas Rockefeller was nowhere near who he seemed to be. So before we get into that backstory, why don't you tell us first, who was this guy?
Well, he was arguably the greatest imposter in American history, and I'll explain why he makes people like Clark Rockefeller, who is in prison now for murder, and Anna Delvey, who, you know, they made a series about, look like hikers by comparison. So this person, whose real name was Spiro Pavlovich, a native Plaquemines Parish in New Orleans, died last Halloween with his secret intact. And that secret was that he was not Nicholas Rockefeller, who he had been pretending to be for 40 years. So he got away with his con and he burrowed his way into the upper reaches of the American establishment, fooling even real Rockefellers until his death. And there are few, if any, imposters going back through history who basically won in the end. Now, he didn't win monetarily because his cons didn't yield as much money as some other grifters, but that wasn't really his primary ambition. He was mostly a sociopathic social climber.
So how did this big grift begin?
This person, Spiro Pavlovich, fooled the admissions offices of Harvard and Yale at least five times on behalf of himself and his wife. So the grift began when Spiro Pavlovich, who liked to be called Bud because he didn't want to be confused with Vice President Spiro Agnew, who was rather unpopular at the time. When Spiro Pavlovich was a student at Tulane, a legitimate student at Tulane in the late 1960s, you know, he was smart, very smart, but dropped out of Tulane and then faked an application to Harvard Law School. And he attended Harvard Law School for 2 years and then was thrown out because while interviewing for a job with a prestigious law firm, he lied so promiscuously that he was caught. And basically, one of the lawyers interviewing him sort of, okay, he could believe maybe he was related to Tsar Nicholas and the other kinds of tall tales he was telling. But when he said that he was a great scuba diver, this guy who was interviewing him knew that he was full of shit. He alerted Harvard, and Spiro was quietly expelled. He went back to Louisiana, and he changed his name to a name out of a Harold Robbins novel, The Carpetbaggers. He called himself Jason Scott Court, and he reapplied. He had the chutzpah, the moxie, to reapply and fake more transcripts, and he was admitted to Harvard Law School again. And then after he was there for 2 years and had brought his wife up and got her admitted to Harvard Business School under false pretenses, and she used the name Monica Cabot, which her classmates thought was a little suspicious since she was a Cabot speaking with a Southern accent, he was busted again by a law firm, not by Harvard, and this time for lying and saying he'd kicked the longest field goal in Southern Conference history at Louisiana State University. But this time, he had applied for federally insured student loans. Harvard turned him over to the FBI, and he was arrested. And that's when I came into the picture 49 years ago. I was a student at Harvard, and I wrote for the Harvard Crimson, and I was trying to impress the upperclassmen, who included Mad Money's Jim Cramer and Steve Ballmer, who became CEO of Microsoft, and a guy named Nick Lemon, who became dean of the Columbia Journalism School. And these were the upperclassmen I was trying to impress. So I read this little Associated Press story about this guy who had been arrested for twice faking his way into Harvard Law School. And I turned it into a long Crimson article and interviewed a lot of people who knew Spiro Pavlovich and his wife, Monette Caulfield, his the Bonnie to his Clyde, and wrote this article. And then I hadn't thought of it, that article, in literally 49 years. And this January, I got an email from a guy named Richard Painter, who's a kind of a well-known ethicist on TV a lot. And he said, are you the Jonathan Alter who wrote this Crimson article? He attached it. I said, yeah, that was me. And he said, we need to talk. And Richard told me that after Nicholas Rockefeller died last fall, and they couldn't find next of kin, and they started to see signs that he was an imposter, they lifted his prints from the morgue and put him into the FBI computer. And it turned out that Nicholas Rockefeller, who knew Bill Clinton and Xi Jinping and had ascended to arguably the upper reaches of the American establishment, was actually Spiro Pavlovich.
Okay, so Jonathan, he's not just fooling the Harvard admissions team. I mean, he's fooling some of the most important people in this country. Give us some examples of those who fell under his spell.
After he was busted a second time for faking his way into Harvard Law School, he cycled way down and became a kind of grifter, almost a garden variety grifter as he plotted his comeback. And then he faked Oxford transcripts and was admitted to Yale Law School in 1984. And then he later got his wife, who did not pose as a Rockefeller, she used a different name, admitted to Yale Law School. And he graduated and he did well at Yale Law School. But remember, by this time, he'd been to 3 years of Yale Law School and 4 years of Harvard Law School. So it's not that surprising that by the time he was at Yale, he was doing pretty well in law school. And he was also a bright guy. And so he got a clerkship with a federal judge in California who considered him. I have a letter from her to him saying that he was one of the finest clerks she ever had. And I don't want to actually tell you yet what happened to him in terms of seriously abusing and ripping off other people, because those are in part two and part three of my airmail story. But initially, pretty early on, he was able to use the fact that he was a prominent Los Angeles lawyer, Yale-educated Los Angeles lawyer, and a Rockefeller to make contacts with all different kinds of people. I wouldn't say they fell under his sway, except those close to him. But, you know, he was a Davos man. So I have a picture of him on stage with Klaus Schwab, the founder of Davos. And he'd often go to Davos. And he was a elected member of the Council on Foreign Relations, prestigious organization, on the board of several other organizations like that. And then he started his own in Los Angeles called the Committee on Foreign Relations, making people think that it was the Los Angeles offshoot of the legendary Council on Foreign Relations. It was not. It was his little organization, but he used it to attract, you know, Wesley Clark and Madeleine Albright and Steve Forbes and all kinds of other people. And one person who went to one of those events where Madeleine Albright appeared said that from Nick Rockefeller's comments and insights, you would have thought that it was Nick Rockefeller who was the former Secretary of State. So he was operating at that level while being an imposter all the time.
What fascinates me, you know, listening to you, it's a riveting story. Here's a guy who, and you have a great sort of moment in the story this week where you say, like, geez, lo and behold, no one thinks to call the Rockefeller family office and say, hey, just checking, is this guy really a Rockefeller? What I'm hearing from you is, like, smart people oftentimes just like, well, I guess he's in the club, so he must be who he says he is, right? And they just go along with it, and they don't realize that, you know, if you line up enough of the dots, people will connect them in their minds and give them legitimacy, which is astounding to me, and yet I guess it's human nature, psychology. But you also say, you know, while all great con artists believe their own cons, they differ in their motivations. And I'm just wondering, what do you think motivated this guy?
It's a great complicated question because he's a complicated sociopath, or was a complicated sociopath. So on the first question, there were people who tried to search and see if they could find whether he was really a Rockefeller, because his stories were so unbelievable. He was such a bullshit artist that there were people who got suspicious. But what he did was rather clever. Initially, he would suggests that he was in the branch of the family that included Nelson Rockefeller, David Rockefeller. But then later, he hung a portrait of William Rockefeller in his office. And William Rockefeller was the brother of J.D. Rockefeller and the co-founder of Standard Oil in the 19th century. But his branch of the family is little known. And William Rockefeller also had a mustache. And to your point about how suggestible people are. If you have a big LA office, as he did, they would walk in, they'd see the picture of William Rockefeller from the 19th century, and they'd say, oh, Nick, you look just like him. And he would say, yeah, I guess people have said that. In terms of what motivated him, this came to fascinate me, that he wanted to be in the show. You know, if you remember from Bull Durham, that's what they call the major leagues. So he was a grifter and he wanted money, but mostly he wanted to be on top with the people who run the country and run the world. The idea of being big is what motivated him initially. And that's why, you know, eventually, instead of using, you know, his own name at Harvard Law School the first time, or the name from the Harold Robbins novel at Harvard Law the second time, after he had cycled down and been severely depressed and hospitalized, he decided to go as big as possible, which meant becoming a Rockefeller. And he completely inhabited the role. This was not a person leading a double life where he, you know, by day he was Nicholas Rockefeller and by night he was Spiro Pavlovich. He was Nicholas Rockefeller all the time for the last 40 years. And because all great con men believe their own cons, I think he had long since come to believe that he actually was a Rockefeller.
Well, Jonathan, let's stop you there because there's much more to come. We encourage you to read them all in full. And for now, Jonathan, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And he is the real Jonathan Alter, just in case anyone's wondering.
There's only one place to discover a global snapshot of the current cultural scene. AIRMEL's Arts Intel Report. Our international research tool for what to do and where and when to do it is user-friendly, continuously updated, and meticulously curated. Arts Intel is handy at home, on the road, and when you're planning your next trip. It also includes indispensable lists of restaurants and hotels in key cities around the world, recommended by our well-traveled experts. Explore Arts Intel at airmail.news/arts-intel, and be sure to sign up for our Week in Culture newsletter, which is published every Wednesday afternoon at airmail.news/WIC. I'm Chris Garrett, AIRMEL Deputy Editor, and I never leave home without it. Bon voyage.
Well, it is the weekend. We've got lots going on, but also lots of free time that we need to account for. Michael, I know you've got something to recommend.
Well, fall is here and all the big shows are coming back to streaming. And this is the week that I think one of our shows we've liked returned, The Morning Show with Reese Witherspoon and Jennifer Aniston, streaming on Apple TV as of this week. So I've seen the first episode. I'm not, you know, it's hard to say where the season's going to go, what's going to happen, but there's certainly laying in enough of the plot points. You've got some new people showing up this season. You got the return, though, of John Hamm and others. So they left a lot of cliffhangers. They're picking right up where they're. I'm not going to give too much. I'm just going to say we should all watch it this weekend.
All the entertainment I needed this week came courtesy of the Trump state visit to the UK.
Yeah. What were you most fascinated by? Because I was most fascinated by that. Who do they sit Kate between? Donald Trump. I get that. You know, she can charm him. And then Tiffany Trump's husband.
In the UK, we call that hard work.
Yeah. I don't know how he got so high up on the table, though.
Yeah, no kidding.
And do you, my dear, anything else you'd like to recommend?
Well, I have just started Heartbeats, a memoir by, wait for it, Bjorn Borg.
Yeah, I've already seen the headlines, but it sounds like he's finally owning up to a lot of the rumors that have been around for many decades.
I mean, such a mystifying character, right? A Swedish tennis prodigy who retired from the sport at age 25. He had 11 Grand Slam titles and 5 Wimbledon titles, but then, you know, gave it all up once he realized he could not beat McEnroe. And this is a really immersive, fun memoir, biography, whatever you want to call it.
It's astounding when you realize, like, as you just said, he retired at 25 and here you've got Djokovic, you know, still pushing, but maybe he just wanted to, like, go and enjoy the good life. And he did.
Well, he basically, I mean, a very good life, cocaine and all the rest. I mean, it's got quite an immersive first chapter that kind of takes you in, you know, a relatively low moment for him, but it's fascinating. He had an 11-year career that occupied a large part of the imagination of tennis and certainly of sports ever since. So anyway, it's really fascinating. It's called Heartbeats, a Memoir by Bjorn Borg. And for those of us that are sort of missing the tennis season, it's a nice way to get back into it. We'd like to thank you so much for joining us. Special thanks to our sponsor, Masika. We love fine jewelry. We love diamonds. We love it all. Michael, will you please read us out?
Morning Meeting is produced by Airplay Productions and edited by Jesse Cannon. Our co-editors are Graydon Carter and Alexander Stanley. Our chief operating officer is Bill Keenan, and our deputy editors are Ashley Baker, Chris Garrett, Nathan King, Julie Vitale, and Ash Carter. Our CMO is Emily Davis, and our music supervisor is Randall Poster. Our theme music is The Cute Monster by the Buddy Collette Quintet. A new edition of AIRMEL is published every Saturday, so please subscribe and enjoy all of our stories on airmail.news, which we update every day. You can also find us on Twitter and Instagram at AIRMEL Weekly. We will be back here next Saturday with another edition of Morning Meeting, but in the meantime, be sure to subscribe at Spotify or Apple Music. But most of all, thanks again for joining us.